This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this digital age, we're all so connected.
His 1989 book took us early into the greenhouse world. His 1990s book, The End of Work, is happening kind of right now with robotics and AI. Behind the Third Industrial Revolution adopted by Germany and the Green New Deal, Jeremy Rifkin helps define our age. After 24 books, Rifkin now takes us into a reality redefined. His latest book is Planet Aqua, Rethinking Our Home in the Universe. From Washington, D.C., Jeremy Rifkin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's very nice to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
You know, our bodies are more than half water. We can't live without it. But the real body of Planet Aqua that you're talking about, it's not just the ocean or the rain. Why did you choose something we take for granted, water?
The reason is we have misunderstood the planet we live on for thousands of years. And that misunderstanding has taken us now to an extinction event in the 21st century. So let me start with this question. What would happen if one day all of us 8 billion human beings were to wake up and we look around and we have no identifiable markers that could tell us where we are in time and space, as if we've been transported to some other part of the universe? That's what's happening. We've got 8 billion human beings scared to death. They're experiencing these great atmospheric rivers and massive snows that were never, places where they never had snow. Spring flooding across all of these ecosystems, destroying life. Summer heat waves and droughts, and then fall hurricanes, and the entire civilization seems to be collapsing in front of us. And people are frightened, and they're scared, and they don't know where to turn. And I think what we have to understand is this. We have misjudged the planet we live on for at least the last 6,000 years. We have long believed that we live on a land planet, and we've organized it, our relationship to this planet, based on that idea. Well, we don't live on a land planet. We live on a water planet, maybe unique in the universe. And because of this misunderstanding, this has taken us to the end of the line as a species. Here's what happened. 6,000 years ago, we changed course as a species. Now, Homo sapiens have been here for about 250,000 years, and we're the youngest mammalian species as far as we know. And during that whole time, we did what every other species did. We adapted moment to moment to what was happening on this water planet. Then, so we saw water as a life source, not a resource. 6,000 years ago, it all changed. The last ice age had receded 11,000 years ago. Nice climate came online. We began the transition from nomadic life to sedentary life with agriculture, pasteurization. And then here's what happened. About 6,000 years ago in Mesopotamia, and all the young people learn about that in the textbooks, but they don't learn about what really happened. In Mesopotamia, they became more and more successful at growing grains, which means they could feed more people, which means population started to grow, which means they started to see urban life. And what's interesting about that is that at a certain point, there were too many people and they weren't growing enough grain, all right, to feed them for the beginning of urban life. And this is the great change. They began to realize that they had to have more water to grow the grain, to feed the people in a growing urban society. They began to sequester the entire water planet with the dams and the dikes and the canals and the levees and the artificial reservoirs. And that allowed them to sequester the waters of this planet for the exclusive use of one species so that we could build what we call urban hydraulic civilizations. And it didn't end there. At the same time that they were doing this in Mesopotamia and the Mediterranean, this was happening in India, in the Indus Valley, taking all the great rivers, sequestering them. Then it went over to China with the Yellow River and the Yangtze River, again, sequestering the water planet for the utilitarian use of one species, ours. Then it shifted to the Kumar civilization in Southeast Asia. Then, of course, the great Roman Empire for centuries with the water aqueducts. Later, Greece and Greece, And then much later in the Americas, as you know, the great Mayan civilization in Mexico and Central America, great urban hydraulic civilization. Later, the Incas in South America. And you know when it all culminated? In this century, in the 20th and 21st century, with these great hydroelectric power dams, massive artificial lakes and rivers, dikes and levees, and all sorts of piping systems. So here's the hubris. We thought that we could actually sequester an entire water planet for the utilitarian purposes of one species. And now we're in an extinction event. Here's why. In the last 200 years, we upped the ante with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, what we call the Age of Progress. We went under the ground. We dug up the burial grounds of a previous period of history, the Carboniferous era, 350 million years ago. We dug up the dead remains of plant and animal life. We exhumed them in the form of coal, oil, and natural gas. And we began spewing these energies into our atmosphere. And what happened is, as we spewed more CO2 and methane and nitrous oxide in the atmosphere over two centuries of the Industrial Revolution, the capitalist and socialist systems, the Age of Progress, there's so much of that fossil fuels in the atmosphere that they're blocking the sun's heat from getting off the planet. For every 1 degree Celsius that the temperature goes up on this planet from global warming emissions, the atmosphere is sucking up 7% more precipitation from the ocean, the lakes, the rivers, the streams, the soil, the trees, the plants, more evaporation of water quicker into the atmosphere, and then massive water events, atmospheric rivers in the winter and massive snowfalls, in the spring flooding across every ecosystem, destroying life, in the summer the heat waves and the droughts and the wildfires across entire continents, in the fall the hurricanes. We're experiencing this every day, everywhere in the world. And so what's happened is our scientists are telling us we are in the sixth extinction of life on this planet. Doesn't even make the headlines. We might lose over half the species on this planet in the lifetime of today's babies. We'll never see these species or hear them again. They've been here for millions of years. The last extinction event was 65 million years ago. So we're either frightened or we're silenced. We don't know what to do. What we need to understand is this. Our astronauts told us the issue. They gave us the problem. You're old enough to remember. 1972, the Apollo mission to the moon. So as they are closing in on the moon, one of the astronauts took a little home camera, looked back at our planet, and shot a photo. What we thought we would see is a beautiful green planet and all of its shades of green, a land planet. What we saw was a beautiful blue planet and all of its shades of blue. And this was a wake-up call. We live on a water planet, maybe unique in the universe. And so in 2021, the European Space Agency said, this is planet Aqua. It changes everything. Then NASA came along a couple years later and said, yeah, this is a water planet. And because we've misjudged this, we have not been able to come to grips with the world we've created. So I think that's the beginning of the question of where do we go from here? And what I would say is this. We don't have a playbook for this because the assumptions we're using to address this crisis are the assumptions that gave rise to the crisis. So whether you're the World Bank or the OECD or the IMF or the United Nations, all these institutions, they're using all of the playbook that gave us the Industrial Age, the Age of Progress, that gave us the capitalist and socialist economic systems. And that playbook doesn't take us anywhere because that playbook gave us an extinction event. So I wrote the book saying we need to understand, first and foremost, that we've misunderstood this planet. We are a water planet. We are not a land planet. And if that's the case, which it is, we got to have a whole new playbook. And it has to be ontological, philosophical. We have to rethink our economic ways of life. We have to rethink how we educate our children, how we address scientific questions, even how we orient ourselves in time and space. It's a new playbook. And what I say in the book is the elements of that new playbook are already coming online, but they haven't been put together in a story so they can scale and hopefully allow us to begin to relearn how to live on a water planet with a completely new paradigm and framework for our day-to-day lives. That's what's missing.
And you do several case studies in your book, and one of them you call the near death and rebirth of the Mediterranean. And certainly that area has been in the news because a month's worth of rain got dumped on eastern Spain around Valencia in a day, and then again in Barcelona. Jeremy, does this event, these kind of things, these disasters, tie into your narrative in your new book, Planet Aqua?
I've been getting, of course, doing interviews all day long for the last several weeks, starting with what happened in the United States with the two hurricanes that hit Florida and went all the way up to Asheville, North Carolina, an entire region of the country wiped out, communities, homes, infrastructure, buildings, people's lives, our fellow creatures. Then right after that, we get Valencia in Spain. And what happened is they weren't prepared. So thousands and thousands of people came out with shovels and pails. That's all they had to help their neighbors to make sure that they weren't dying. This is happening everywhere. What we need to understand is the entire infrastructure of this planet that we've created in the industrial age, but all the way back, all of these urban hydraulic civilizations, is a stranded asset. It's collapsing in real time. The floods, the droughts, the heat waves, the wildfires, etc. But the interesting thing is there is a way to rethink all of this. And that's what I try to address in the book, in Planet Aqua. But it requires clearing our heads for a new way to live on the planet we're on.
Well, definitely a new way to live. And one of the things you suggest is that partly due to migration and partly due to climate problems, I would presume, people become more mobile. And you talk about neo-nomads. Would you explain where that's coming from?
Let me take that aside for a few minutes, all right? And what I would like to do is back up for a moment and suggest something that will be interesting, I think, to your listeners. I spent about 25 years here on this whole question of climate change. And then around 2001, I began to work with the Green Parties in Europe in the 1980s and 90s. And then around 2001, Romano Prodi was president of the European Commission at that time, formerly prime minister of Italy, came to visit me in Washington and said, look, America is not going to be a first mover. Come to Europe for the next 20 years. We're going to get this done. We're going to really figure out a new way to live on this planet. So you know what we did? The first thing was to throw out the whole playbook, the Enlightenment, the Age of Progress, the Industrial Revolutions, nation-state sovereignty, throw it all out and ask, how did the great paradigm shifts in history occur? Anthropological. That changed our lives. Because if we have a roadmap of how they occur, maybe we can begin to change the way we're organizing our relationships on this planet. When we look back at history, it was pretty fascinating. We found that there are several major paradigm shifts in history, and they're all identical in terms of their common denominator. And that is, at a moment of time, four new technology revolutions emerge serendipitously. They just emerge around the same time, and they converge to create an infrastructure that fundamentally changes the way we organize our existence on this planet. What are they? Number one, new communication revolutions. Number two, new energy regimes. Number three, new modes of mobility and logistics. Number four, the big one, new ways to steward the waters of the planet. When that happens, it changes everything. It changes our economic paradigm, our forms of governance, our approach to science, how we educate our kids, the works. And we always think that governments create these infrastructures and just scaffolding. No, these infrastructures that kind of emerge, they define the kinds of governance you may have, the kinds of economy you might have, the kinds of academic pedagogy you might have. It's not rigid. You can have a lot of variations, but you can't go outside of the infrastructure. And why? Well, every young person that's listening to this podcast knows that in high school biology, you learn that every species, even little single cell organisms, they have to have a means to communicate. They have to have some source of energy thermodynamically to survive. Number two. Number three, they have to have mobility or motility. Even plants, they have to move with the sun, etc. And four, they have to have water. So what we learned, which is kind of embarrassingly simple, is that all the great infrastructure revolutions are simply social organisms that bring large numbers of our people together in differentiated skills to act as a social organism for communication, energy, mobility, logistics, and work. That's a simple proposition, but that's what we found. So, for example, if you look at the first industrial revolution, and that's in the British Isles. What was the communication revolution? Steam power printing, 19th century. No more manual printing presses. Then they lay out a telegraph system in the second half of that century. Instant communication. The energy regime, they dug under the ground and took up the coal because they'd already depleted the forest for firewood. All right? The mobility revolution, locomotives, 60 miles an hour, railroads, so you could have urban life city to city. The water revolution, they were the first since the fall of Rome to put in sophisticated water systems and sewer systems centralized. This took us to urban life, nation-state governance, shareholding corporations, modern capitalism, etc. Then you look at the second industrial revolution, which was our country, the United States. The second revolution was around 1900. The communication revolution was the telephone across the continent, instant communication. The energy revolution was oil. We struck oil in Texas. We didn't need to rely on coal primarily. The mobility revolution was the automobile, and later inland water, ocean, and air traffic on internal combustion transport. And the water revolution was the great hydroelectric power dams from the Hoover Dam in America to Three Gorges in the 20th century and the final collapse of the hydraulic civilization because of the floods, the droughts, the heat waves, the lava. But every urban hydraulic civilization has come and gone, had a birth, a life, and a collapse because of the entropy bill, the thermodynamics of it, or the change in climate. So this is our fraught history for 6,000 years. And now the good news here it really is that we have a clean slate because the entire infrastructure is now a stranded asset. And that means crisis creates opportunity. We have to create an entire new paradigm for how we live on a water planet on every aspect of our life in three generations that separate Gen Zs from the alphas and betas, the next three generations. Huge opportunity. That's kind of where the starting off point is. Now, we are in the midst of this third industrial revolution. We're right there. The communication internet, it's already here. It's called cell phones. We've got 4.5 billion people with a little iPhone cell phone in their hand, cheap, with more computing power than sent our astronauts to the moon. That's amazing. The energy revolution, sun and wind. We now have millions and millions and millions of people harvesting the sun and wind where they live, where they work, in their neighborhoods and communities. And they're sharing it over time zones and pretty soon over oceans. This is happening in real time. The mobility revolution, electric and transport, and coming quickly, hydrogen fuel cell transport, powered by sun and wind from the energy internet, and then using big data and analytics from the communication internet to organize day-to-day life, all distributed. Then they're now just coalescing with water internets. In 2021, the Battelle think tank for the Department of Energy said it's time for the water microgrids because water doesn't disappear. Everyone's confused about floods and droughts. Water doesn't disappear. Those molecules are here forever. But they change how they're coming down, when and where and what amount. So the key now is to capture the water when it's coming down. So instead of flooding it out, capture it on rooftops all over the world. And then store it in micro water grids underneath, if we can, ground. And then use that water when there's droughts and heat waves and wildfires, et cetera, when you need it. So that's distributed too. And so what we're learning now is that we're beginning to see a completely distributed economic system that's totally different than the industrial age that we had before. Completely different. It changes our entire economic system and capitalism and everything else.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Indeed, this sounds like almost a project to build on Mars because it's rebuilding everything. I mean, you think of Britain and the pipes there were built to handle whatever rains they got in that rainy place during the 1800s, 1900s, the worst they could imagine. And now they don't work. They don't work at all. So what are we going to do with the water systems we've got, our underground piping, all the dams that we've built?
We're not going to do anything. They're collapsing. In the book, I spent quite a bit of time on all the studies from the World Meteorological Organization, all the hydraulic civilization. And this is not theory. There's nothing in this book that's academic from, you know, something we'd like to think about. There's 480 footnotes. They're all from the industries involved with this. We will see the collapse of the great hydroelectric power dams. They're already starting in the next 30 years, 40 years, because the hydrosphere is rewilding. we're learning that the hydrosphere is much more powerful than we thought, and our little species is much tinier and not very significant. So when people talk about how we manage this, no. What's happening is the hydrosphere is determining where the new ecosystems will be. The hydrosphere is freeing itself, and it's changing with floods, droughts, heat waves, and wildfires where the ecosystems are and what they're going to be about. The problem with us is we've been trying to adapt the hydrosphere to us for 6,000 years of urban hydraulic civilization, but now we have to learn how to adapt our little species to where the hydrospheres are taking us. That's the key. If we don't understand that, we're not going to make it. So there's a lot of interesting things taking place, but what's most interesting, it changes our economic system. The first and second industrial revolutions were centralized. They had to be. And I don't care if it was in the United States or the Soviet Union. They all had to do the, you know, the same thing, the hydroelectric power dams and everything else, all right? So they were centralized because fossil fuels are central. They're only found in a few places. They require huge financial investment to explore them, to bring them up, to purify them, and to run them down the line, all right? It's so expensive, they require something called the shareholding corporation to put enough money to get that in place, that infrastructure, to return investments. The reason we have these massive military establishments in today is because you have to protect fossil fuels. We fought a lot of wars in the Middle East. Look at World War II. When the French went into the Ruhr Valley of Germany to get the coal, which was their energy source, and they captured it, it was inevitable. When the United States dropped shipments of oil to Japan in July of 1941, and they got our British partners to do it in Asia, they bombed Pearl Harbor 4 months later. We fought a lot of wars for fossil fuels. What's happening now is this infrastructure is not centralized. It's distributed. This is what I want to share, especially with your audience. The first generation of companies in this third industrial revolution were all centralized, right? So it's Dell, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, et cetera. Well, how does this accompany the idea that I think everything's distributed? When I mean distributed, hundreds of millions of people are, it's millions now, but hundreds of millions of people, and then much of the human race will be harvesting their own sun and wind in 20 years from now, 30 years from now. This has already happened. We're seeing the scale. It's not something we're thinking about theoretically. We also know that millions of people in the next 20 years are going to be capturing their own water in microgrids and distributing it when they need it, when there's droughts. We also know that millions of people are going to be in electric vehicles, and they can share that electricity back to the power grid if they want and be paid for it. It's distributed. And now we're realizing that the big centralized AI organizations, they're probably not going to be here in 40 years from now. And there's a several reasons for it. We have too much data. So we have things like the Galileo system, the GPS system, these great brains outside, these satellites all these countries have. The nervous system is the Internet of Things. We're putting IoT, little sensors, in the wild so we can monitor our ecosystem. We're putting it in the agricultural fields to monitor the crops and the soil, in our factories and our road systems. There's so much damn data, and here's the problem. If you are a autonomous taxi, like in San Francisco, they're now autonomous. There are no drivers. And you're about to crash, and you send that data to a remote data center, it's too late. It's called the latency factor. All right? So what's happening? Edge data centers are coming in. Right now, they're starting all over the industrial world, and pretty soon the developing world. There are going to be millions of edge data centers where you can have local communities and neighborhoods, just like they have their own solar and wind and harvest it, and they can share it across systems if they want. They have their own water microgrids. They can share it, distribute it. They have their own electric vehicles, but now edge data centers. So that it allows high-tech SMEs to be able to create these ecosystems with these data centers that are edge data centers in all over the world. So what's going to happen is some of the big companies will still be here. Many will not. The ones that remain will only be aggregators working with high-tech SMEs. And I'll give an example of what I mean. We're moving from globalization to glocalization. All of this is happening. At the same time, we have a geopolitical war all over the world at the end of this age where everyone's fighting each other. They're fighting for every way they can to protect their sovereignty, correct? Well, what's happening is the waters are now telling us they don't care about national boundaries. climate events do not respect nation-state boundaries. Climate events, the droughts, the heat waves, the wildfires, they affect ecosystems. So what's happening is we're beginning to see the need to change our government somewhat, to extend governance. You don't leave nation states right away, but bioregional governances are now forming, an extension of government so that you can cross political boundaries and share common ecosystems that are affected by the global warming issues of atmospheric rivers, massive snows, floods, droughts, heat waves, and wildfires. This is happening. Now, this is the one place America's at. You probably know we have two great bioregional governances. One in the Cascadia region, Northwest Pacific region of the U.S., Washington State, Oregon, Montana, Idaho, etc., Saskatchewan, British Columbia, Manitoba. They share that ecosystem, and you cannot abuse it. You have to steward it, not manage it and take it, all right? We don't want the Oral Sea again. That was that great lake, as big as Lake Michigan, was destroyed in 40 years because they used it up. We have another bioregional governance in the Great Lakes. 8 U.S. states, 2 Canadian provinces. They share it as a commons that has to be treated as a life source, not as a resource. And those 5 Great Lakes, they are 20% of all the remaining fresh water on the entire planet. Right there. Yeah, that's amazing. Now, China, where I've worked with the leadership in the last 2 5-year plans, just like we're working with Europe, they have 8 bioregions that have now been set up. In Europe, we only have 1, between France and Spain, and the Occitania, Balearic Islands, and Catalonia. But in the next European Commission, I work with them, we're going to get bioregional governance around there. So we're moving from globalization to globalization. This is how it affects our whole approach to what economics is about. I don't care if you're a capitalist or a socialist or, you know, Adam Smith or Karl Marx. It's going to change, and here's why it's going to change. Let's say that we're going to globalization, and let's say that you are a architect and you're building a building. Now, in the first and second industrial revolutions, we had what we call subtractive manufacturing. You make a product and you have to give up a lot of the material to get the final product. You're making a home, some of the bricks don't work or the glass, you're making a machine, some of the wiring isn't working, etc. It's called subtractive manufacturing. That's gone. We now have something called 3D printing, fabricated manufacturing. It's additive. And so a software heats up something, let's say cement, you don't want to do that because it's CO2. So let's say they do clay. An architect named Cucinello in Italy. He uses clay because that's what we've used for buildings for thousands of years. The software, 3D printer, tells the clay how to warm up and then create an entire building and everything in it. You can do it in 1, 2, or 3 days. There are thousands of architects now doing this, all right? He can go from a seller buyer market in a capitalist system to a provider user network in this new distributed infrastructure. You know what he can do? He can take his little cell phone at near zero marginal cost, and he can take the instruction for building that building. He can send to an architect in the Philippines in 20 seconds. And that architect, she can build out as many buildings she wants on a provider user network. This is globalization, again, distributed. And that means that ocean traffic and air traffic is going to be more problematic because of the climate events. Sometimes the airplanes can't take off. Sometimes the shipping can't take off. So these are fundamental changes, and there's many more in the book, but they're not theoretical. They're starting to scale, and they're getting cheaper and cheaper than the old system. The question is, can we get there in time? Is there political will? And how do we deal with fossil fuel industries that are still hanging on?
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Jeremy Rifkin. Yes, you have the long view of time, and it sounds like an orderly evolution almost of human development and natural development, but your latest book does seem darker than your earlier visions for transformation. For example, in Planet Aqua, you suggest billions of people might die and billions more will be displaced, and we may have shanty towns or tent cities, although we can do better than that. But there is a tone of acceptance. What changed for you?
It's not acceptance, it's knowing what's happening. For every 1 degree Celsius the temperature goes up, potentially upwards of 1 billion people may have to move. That's in the scientific and technological literature. That's not me. For every 1 degree Celsius, potentially migration, and mainly from the subtropics and the central latitudes north. I'll give you an interesting story. So the German government, Germany, and I'm a big fan of Germany, I've worked with the government there for years, they had an organization that's part of the government do a study. And the organization did a study, and what they found in this study is that we need to begin to have orderly passage from countries that are in jeopardy to countries that may still have ecosystems that will be viable, right? And they said first start in the Pacific because those island nations are now going into the water. But then we have to move everywhere else. So they said we need to think about climate passports, and I would say climate corridors. What do I mean by this? We had a situation like this after World War I. The great empires collapsed. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Persian Empire. So where there were empires, they had to remake them. So the U.S. government, I think, had a couple of guys in the State Department create new countries. But then people in these new countries, it wasn't their country. So they couldn't move and they couldn't stay. So they issued what they called the Nansen Report passport, named after the guy who created this idea of the passport. So you get a little passport and then you could go across political boundaries until you found a nation belonging to the League of Nations that would accept it. So this German government advisory commission said, we need the same thing. But even after it came about, even Germany said, well, wait, not so fast. And the UN, they said, maybe what you need to do, because they didn't want this. The UN said, why don't we just try to help countries around the world to be more resilient? We need to do that. But there's going to be countries not livable. Why do you think so many people are rushing across the Mediterranean from the Middle East where it's all desert? They don't have any water. They're dying in the Mediterranean on rickety boats trying to get to Europe and then move. Why is it there are so many people coming up from Mexico and Central America and South America, and they'll risk going 1,000 miles sometimes to get over the border and go north? People aren't talking about it. The media doesn't talk about it. Even the environmental groups don't talk about it. This is reality. We're going to have climate corridors and climate passports. What I mean by climate corridors is that we need to find ways that people can move from regions that they can't live in to new regions. And what we're doing, the scientific and technical community is already creating climate passports. You know how they're doing it? They're following our fellow creatures. From the insects to the mammals, they're all moving to try to stay in line with their biological clocks and the physiology with the climate they've known for millions of years. So you follow them on these climate corridors and they're beginning to map them. But we have to stay somewhat removed so that we don't get too close and harm them. And then we have to have climate passports. Then the question is, how do we begin to see, we've always been nomadic. You know, we are a nomadic creature. When people said, oh, we're going to be nomads again, you asked that. We have people all over the world that are traveling every day all over the world. They maybe work in one part of the world and then they come back part of the year to another part of the world. When I was a kid, you had one passport. Now, because of a global world, you can have many passports. People have dual passports with several countries because they're mobile and they're moving in various places in various continents. We used to have the issue you'd have to have visas traveling to a foreign country. Now, countries all over the world have gotten rid of visas, a few still haven't, so that you can have that kind of movement. Travel and tourism is the biggest industry in the world. It's movement. The average 19-year-old in our country lives in nine different places in different regions during their lifetime. So we've always been nomadic, but now we're going to be a little less sedentary and a little bit more nomadic. Then we need to build ephemeral cities, not refugee camps. And that is, with 3D printing, we can begin to assemble these camps very, very quickly and then disassemble and move them when we need to. The technology is there, but additive manufacturing. Those places should be ephemeral cities, not refugee camps, where they're governed by the people in those regions. So I know that we try to have these refugee camps that save people's lives, but they don't get control over them as a city where those who are there manage them. These are all things that are in the drawing board at this point with industries and with folks that are looking at climate change. But it's not in the popular conversation. Not yet, but it will be. And then there's all the universities that are putting together what we call incubator labs all over the world to try to look at all the new technologies go with living on a water planet. They're all over the world. So these are new things that we have to come to grips with. We can't just say, oh, this can't be done, or we don't think it's possible. We have no alternative because we're heading to an extinction event. But we have a great opportunity with a crisis that's collapsing what we live, how we live. So the question is, will we get there?
Well, at the time we speak, the global sea ice is at an all-time low. It was 81 degrees Fahrenheit, 27 C in New York City on Halloween Day. Global temperatures are always setting new records. Jeremy, if you have a mental climate map, where do you think we are?
I often get grandparents and parents asking, will my children be here and be able to live in this world, you know, and have a life? And now the young people are saying, I don't want to have children. They're all completely depressed about their future everywhere. What I say to the parents and grandparents is this. Our first industrial revolution, the 19th century in America, we did it all in 30 years. After the Civil War, the whole economy was in shambles. Families had killed each other across boundaries from north to south, relatives. The economy was just collapsed. What did we do? We laid out a railroad system, continental railroad system, across the entire North America. We did it right after the Civil War. That's number one. Number two, a new energy regime. We were able to distribute coal across the country. Communication revolution, the telephone. All right? The telegraph. Okay, we did all that in 30 years. Then we put together land-grant universities provided by the government. They gave free land for universities to allow them to create themselves, and then they could sell the land and actually build the universities. So we created these great land-grant universities that are now the centerpiece right now of our country, the Michigan University of Michigan, the Michigan State, or the California system, or the Ohio State system. Then we laid out the dams, et cetera, that we needed for the water. We did all that. Second Industrial Revolution we did in 25 years in the urban areas, starting in 1900. We put the telephone across the urban areas around 1900. Then we put in electricity lines across the urban areas starting around that time. Then we put out millions of automobiles over the next 20 years. Then we put in pipe systems for the gas for the automobiles. We did all that in 25 years. The world took another 20. This is what we did. We're now in the third industrial revolution infrastructure, and we did a plan for Senator Schumer. I met with him for about 14 months. He was aware of the fact that we'd worked with the leadership of the EU and China for a long time. He said, how about a plan that's really for us? And so I spent personal time with him. We put together the engineers, the scientists, the policy people from around the world that we had done other plans, development plans. And we put together a huge plan, $17 trillion plan. Much of it didn't get in the plan, but some of it did. This is a matter of will. It's not a matter of the market. These technologies are all cheaper than the old technology they're replacing. The ideas are there. And we have actually done this kind of development in other regions. Let me share that for a moment. We've had successes and failures. And let me explain the difference. I'll give you one region that we worked in for 10 years. It's Hauts-de-France. It's the region from Lille to Dunkirk. It's the industrial region of France, the Rust Belt region of France, but still the major industrial area of France. It's the same home of Macron and Marie Le Pen. So when they came to me, the premier of that region, said, would you do a plan for us? And I said, no, don't waste your time and don't waste your money. We've learned a lot from failures. Because if we do a plan for you, some minister will put it out as a pilot project and you'll think you've solved the problem. You can go to 12,000 mayors today and they'll show you all over the world. There's 5 electric buses. There are bicycle paths. I said, don't waste your time because we've seen failures. some that we were involved in. But he said, is there anything we can do? And I said, there is, but you're not going to like it. Go back to your region, the industrial region of France, and you line up every chamber of commerce, every mayor of every municipality, all 26 universities, all 260 high schools. You line up the entire society for 10 years of engagement to make the transition. You make it. We will help you. They don't come back. I'm telling you, I can't tell you how many times they never come back. This guy actually came back. Months later, we got it. We're ready. We spent 10 years with them. They did it. And they're the poster child of Europe. And there are films. I'll send you a little documentary showing what they did. New tech parks, new way, putting in solar and wind across the region, transforming the universities so they were clinical universities and team teaching. They did all of it. This could be done anywhere. They even taught grandchildren of coal miners to retrofit buildings and put up solar and wind.
To do these things, for example, in America, we would have to have the public support. The leaders say, well, we can't go too far, and this happens in all countries, so we can't go too far ahead of our population. And there's been a long-time myth, I think, in the environmental movement that the next big climate disaster will cause some sort of social tipping point, an awakening, and masses of people will finally demand action. But that hasn't happened. We've seen disaster after disaster. So if we let go that myth of learning by disaster, what do we have left?
What you just said is very profound. And you hit really seriously the problem. Everyone thinks there'll be this critical turning point, and then we'll deal with this. It hasn't happened. It's like the frog in the pot heating up, and they'll boil themselves to death. They don't jump. What's happening now is something different. And that is, we are moving from geopolitics, even though we all think it's all geopolitics now, it's the last gasp of the industrial age. We are moving out of that. It's dying. But everybody in every nation state is trying to hold on in a geopolitical world. That's what's going on with all these elections. They don't know them. That's what it's all about. It's the fear, because it's a paradigm dying after two centuries of the economic system we've had and the industrial age, et cetera. And so what's happened is that in that wake, we're beginning to realize, as I said before, that these climate events don't honor political boundaries. They affect ecosystems. And when you affect an ecosystem, you have to cross those political boundaries, whether it's a national boundary, a state boundary, or municipal boundary, and work together. Because you have to deal with preparation, rescue, restoration, and reclamation. So what's happening at the local level is bioregional governances are coming in. They don't mean the end of nation states, but it's an extension into bioregions. And this is going to be crucial. And it takes us into a world that Eleanor Ostrom talked about with commons. You have to share your commons as a life source, not a resource, and not exploit it and manipulate it and commodify it and use it up. When you begin working with each other and neighbors to do this, and it becomes more formalized with citizen science juries. You remember the Porto Alegre thing where you said, let's have, you know, a situation where we can have the public decide the what governments expend their money on, remember? And it went all over the world. Everyone's doing this. Well, you have to do this with citizen science juries. And that means you have to start when the kids are in grade school. They can't learn about nature on a two-minute Zoom or a two-minute video. They have to be out there in clinical learning, in the environment. There's no other way to do it. If we lock ourselves away in a virtual habitat, we'll become increasingly frightened of the outside world. Right now, the average American spends 92% of the time indoors and 7 hours a day on a cell phone in virtual worlds. That's not good. And we're not alone. This is happening all over the world. So our young people are frightened of nature, don't think about nature, but there's a significant amount of them that are moving in a new direction. This is where the hope comes in. Maybe we could talk about that and you know, where do we think there are possibilities to make this change so we don't have to be in this rut we're in?
By all means, please tell us some of the alternatives and possibilities that we've got, because we need them.
Well, there's a couple of interesting things. First is this. I didn't come up with any of these ideas. What happened is they sort of came up, and then people started to get into them in various countries around the world and companies and whatever, But each step, we didn't see the next step. And what we began to see is these infrastructure revolutions, like this third industrial revolution infrastructure, it created its own futures by whatever that existed, allowed them, the new technology they create, to actually take it to the next stage and with the other parts of the infrastructure. So first the communication internet. And when I wrote the book End of Work in 1995, we just had the communication internet. Then in 2000, I wrote the hydrogen economy book because at that point we were beginning to take a look at an energy internet with solar and wind, just starting. And then a little bit later, the technology wrote us again with the mobility internet. Then the technology again, more recently, came up with the water internets and edge data centers. So that when you get all the generation starting to think of these new technologies, they have a way of creating a situation that you didn't expect at the first, at the get-go. So this is a little chart from our experience. And see if this resonates with you, all right? We have a real shift going on with the younger generation. They may not articulate it, but they're shifting from capitalism to hydroism. It's just beginning. Capital, the business community thinks capital is your intellectual property, the machines you have, your inventory, et cetera. That's secondary. In nature, the only capital that we rely on is photosynthesis and net primary production. Without that, you don't have species, you don't have capital, derivatory capital. That's it. So the real capital is the water planet. Without water, the hydrosphere, you don't have the elements for life. The waters of the hydrosphere, they weather the rocks and the mountains, like Grand Canyon. They weather those rocks. Then when the rocks become elements, they become the sediment of the soil. Then the elements go to the plants, then into the animals, then into our bodies. Then the molecules, the atoms go somewhere else. The phosphorus in my tooth came from a mountain. Okay? So we take the water from the planet, the molecules come in with 60% of our body, then they go somewhere else. We take in the oxygen from the atmosphere, and that relies on the waters, because the oceans create the phytoplankton that then becomes the oxygen and the biosphere. So all of these things are a process that's moving at every moment. Then we're realizing something. This is very hopeful for young people. I'm sitting here and I'm looking out my window at the high-tech corridor of Bethesda Barrel. And there's the Naval Hospital. Next to that is the NIH, the greatest scientific body in the world, the National Institutes of Health. They have a project there that will change the thinking of every single person that listens to your podcast and every kid that grows up in the future. They've created a project called the Human Microbiome Project. Biome is the ecosystem that create a big presence across continents. What they're saying is a mind blow. They're saying that every human being on this planet and every other species is actually an ecosystem. We're not talking about something that's just a thought. It's literal. For example, as I said, we take water molecules in our body. They go somewhere else. The elements from the mountains in the sediment, they go in our bodies. They go somewhere else. The skeleton, human skeleton, is replaced every 10 years. Totally new skeleton from the elements that came from the mountains. Beside that, we realize now that humans are not alone in their own body. We just discovered there are millions of other creatures in our bodies. There's the proteus, the archaea, the fungi, the bacteria, the viruses. Only 44% of the cells in our body are human. The other 56% belong to these other creatures. We only have 20,000 human genes. Watson and Crick probably wouldn't have understood this. There are millions of other genes in our body, the other creatures. So the NIH projects now moved to the European Union and now to China, and they're in Japan, and they're working on it. Think of what it would be if a little kid learns when they're, let's say, in third grade or fourth grade, that every human being is an ecosystem. We're all unique, but we're part of we are an ecosystem within an ecosystem. Would that change the way they feel about nature fundamentally? Would they then think they're part of some bigger experiment called an animated planet? And instead of being afraid, they would say, well, I'm part of this planet. I have a responsibility to steward my relationship to it. And what happens if young people grow up with that thought? It changes everything. What happens if they grow up and then they ask mommy and daddy when they're 5 years old, what is this place we live in? Looking around, And mommy and daddy said, it's a water planet, sweetie. You live on planet Aqua. Wouldn't that change the entire way the young person grows up and thinks about the world around them? There's two other things that give me hope. And that is the Smithsonian Institution, which are the great museums in Washington, did a study along with NYU researchers at New York University. They asked, how did humans survive? We're a pretty thin little weak creature. How did we survive over millennia? And the old story was kind of not much of a story. The last ice age receded. We came out of the Rift Valley of Africa and we ran around the world. Then they went through the geological record and it shocked them. What they found in the geological record is hominids emerged 800,000 years, our ancestors. Then Neanderthals, 350,000 years. Homo sapiens, 250,000 years. And during that period was the most violent, extreme changes in climate that you'll see in much of our planet's history. How did they survive this? So what happened was the planet tilts occasionally over millions of years, sometimes closer to the sun, sometimes further away. No way of knowing about when. It tilted. And when that tilt happened 800,000 years ago and hominids emerged, they began to see a cycle in the geological record of 100,000 years of ice age, 10,000 years of global warming. 100,000 years ice age, 10,000 global warming for 8 cycles. Now, it's not going to happen again because we're now in climate change, which changes the water cycles fundamentally. And they said, how do they survive this, humans? Big brain, the biggest brain, neocortex, and we have language. Other creatures can share knowledge to their offspring, but we can do it in a much more profound way. In other words, we have that ability. Number two, this, the opposable thumb and fingers. We are the best tool makers. We've got the thumbs and fingers. Number three, we're a cooperative species. What we've learned from our scientists in the 1990s is we have mirror neurons. We always knew we were empathic. We have actual neurons, it's not up here, that allow us to actually experience another living creature, a human or another creature, as if we were experiencing our own bodies. We know it's not us, but we feel it. Whether it's their fear, their grief, their happiness, this allows us to cooperate. So there are periods in history where we cooperate in these great social infrastructures, empathy expands, and then when those urban civilizations collapse, we start killing each other off. And so the elements are there for this transition. And the market's there, and the technology is emerging, but the story isn't there. That's what I'm trying to say today, and we need this new story of living on a water planet.
As we wrap up here, what are you working on these days?
Well, I'm putting much of my attention. I'm doing one last book in this last series. The first one was The Age of Resilience. The second was Planet Aqua. I'm doing the last one on how we began to rethink intelligence and what intelligence is all about. How do we begin to rethink intelligence when we realize that there's no such thing as an object or a structure or a passive resource? That everything on this planet is in constant movement at every moment, whether it's the mountains or the hydrosphere, which is the key to all of this, or the atmosphere. And these are processes and patterns and flows in an animated planet. Every moment is changing, like the butterfly effect. The butterfly flaps its wings. That may create a tornado 5 weeks later somewhere. Everything's infected. So when you begin to think of the planet as a living, animated Earth planet, it is. It really is. It's processes and patterns that are always interacting at every moment and creating all sorts of externalities that affect everything else. And the awe of this is inspiring once we realize this. Because that awe that we're part of something much bigger, that's unique, a living planet, not a metaphor. We began to have imagination, a sense of wonder and imagination, and a sense of transcendence. It's a big deal. People know in their gut that they want to be alive. So does every other species. But then the question is, how do we make this relevant to the rest of future generations here? The last thought, the Gen Zs. So I watched the protests. Okay, I don't watch the protests. The Friday for Futures, I'm sure you probably did something on it. You had millions of young people leaving their schools on Friday in 141 countries. They did it like 5-6 times, calling for a climate emergency. And I thought that's good for them. That's good. These protests are important. But then I really didn't understand it until I met with 3 Gen Zs in Milan. And then it hit me. This is the first time an entire generation of human beings on this planet went out on the streets together, and they saw themselves as an endangered species. They didn't articulate it, but they saw themselves as an endangered species, and they saw their fellow creatures as part of their evolutionary family. That's never happened in history. So all the things that have divided us, our loyalties to our nation, our religious ties, our blood ties, all of those things are still here. But this has never happened before, that an entire generation saw themselves as a species in danger, their fellow creatures part of the family. That is so empowering. And I wish that they would hear what I'm saying to them, because they didn't think of that. They just did it. But once you think of it, you can't get rid of that idea. And what happens if they think of that and they're in high schools and universities and they begin to realize, yeah, we're an endangered species, our fellow creatures. We know that, so we have to act as if we are able to steward this planet and learn to live on an animated life planet. So my frustration is, I'm guardedly hopeful. I'm not naive. I don't know if we'll make it. But what I try to do in this planet, Aqua, is say, rethink it. And you know, one last thing on this. I would never imagine 50 years ago that there would be a time when governing regions and even nation states would give rights to the waters. They're doing it, as you know. So they're actually giving rights to waters. And we gave rights to corporations as human rights, you know, the 14th Amendment. So did the UK with their constitution, Canada. So, you know, corporations have rights like humans. But now, if you go to Australia, New Zealand, Quebec, all sorts of places, South America, they're giving rights to waters to be free, to go where they need to go. They're going to go anywhere. And they have guardians that go to court on their behalf. Would you imagine that could happen? What happens if we rebrand this planet, Planet Aqua? What I would say, in some last pages of the book, we should have a second name. Keep Planet Earth for a while, if you want. But in your constitutions and the codes and the legal matters, have a second name, Planet Aqua. And those kids go to school and they realize they live in Planet Aqua, it'll change your entire life. If they realize that they are an ecosystem like every other ecosystem, and they're part of a great experiment called life on the planet, it will change. If they think they're the most adaptive species and they can handle a lot of different climate events over history, and they can make it and maybe flourish in new ways, they'll be able to thrive, hopefully, and flourish. So that's the story. But as long as our journalists, and they're the ones that have to tell the story, only want to ask questions about the current event and what's the new ESG principles and that stuff, everyone knows this is not enough. Not when you have the possibility of rethinking the human journey on this wonderful living planet, universe. Our space administration, they're going out across the whole universe. What are they looking for? Water. So that should be a clue. So now a last thought. There's a little parable in the book. Two little fish are swimming in the ocean. Young fish, having a nice time. This real old fish with white whiskers comes by the other way and stops with them and says, "Hello, boys. How's the water today?" The two little fish, they just keep going. Then a couple of minutes later, one little fish says to the other little fish, "What the hell is water?" It's the medium, so we don't think about it. It's everything. It's what makes life possible. But it's so close to us, we don't think about it. So that parable made sense to me. My hope is that with podcasts like this, a new generation will roll up their sleeves and do some homework and start thinking about this water planet ontologically, philosophically, in terms of economic system, in terms of the new technologies we have to develop, how we do pedagogy and curriculum, how we create clinical learning environments. All these things is a treasure trove to engage future generations in an exciting experiment to bring back this water planet by seeing it as a life source, not a resource, and by understanding how precious this little experiment in the universe is.
We have been speaking with visionary activist and best-selling author Jeremy Rifkin. He founded and operates from the Foundation on Economic Trends. You can dig deeper with links in my blog at ecoshock.org and find Jeremy directly at foet.org. Look for his new book, Planet Aqua, Rethinking Our Home in the Universe. Jeremy, thank you for spending your valuable time with our listeners.
And thank you for giving me the time. I really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
In my eyes, hurricane. changing fast. How long will it last? The change is here.